My name is Will Tuttle, as you heard, and I'd like to give everybody, have a hand to my wonderful spouse, Madeline, from Switzerland. We met, she's joined us, and these are her paintings up here that she's a painter and watercolor artist extraordinaire, and it's really something amazing in a way that we're here today at Unity of Walnut Creek. It didn't really dawn on me till this morning when I told the story, and I thought, wow, that's really pretty amazing because, I got introduced to Unity a long time ago in Atlanta, back in the 70s, I guess it was. And when I came out here to the Bay Area, I started going to a few Unities locally, living in Oakland, and I came out here. And I played the piano, actually, for some of the services. And I've been, it was back when Carol Ruth Knox was the minister, and then Marge Britt. And then Charlene, whatever her name was, Matt Garrigan, I remember he was here, sort of part of it. But anyway, this was really always a very inspiring place. And I got my PhD at Berkeley, and I was teaching college in San Francisco State University and the Academy of Art College in San Francisco. And I decided to take a sabbatical and go to Russia. Actually, it was Soviet Union back then, and do citizen diplomacy to try to build peace between the two countries. And I was doing concerts over there. And then I traveled around Switzerland. And this was in 1990. And I met Madeline in the little town of Spiez in central Switzerland. I was playing the piano at this art gallery there, and she came in and she said, "Do you have any recordings of your music?" I had a little cassette, so she paid me and I mailed it to her somehow. And then I came back and I decided, instead of teaching, going back, I was going to take a sabbatical. So I was traveling in this 1971 Volkswagen bus to Unity churches. I started out in Toronto, and I was just traveling around going to Unity churches. Every Sunday I'd go and play, and then I started speaking. But I started getting these letters from this woman in Switzerland asking me to send her 10 more, 20 more. And she was promoting these little cassettes at music stores all around Switzerland. She had fallen in love with the music. And so I didn't realize that, really. I mean, I realized she was ordering them. And then at one point, she was told that, you really need to do a CD. Because, this was time of CDs coming. And I was thinking the same thing. So I sent out a mailing to my mailing list, and I sent one to her. That I need an artist to do the cover of my first CD. And so this woman from Switzerland contacted me and said, "I'm an artist, I could come over." And I said, "It's not going to work. I'm living in a Volkswagen bus. I have no place to put you." And she was undeterred. She said, "Listen, I've lived in grass shacks in Kenya and longhouses in Borneo. I travel all over Australia in a little van. I won't be any trouble. Don't worry." So I didn't know, but she ended up flying over and staying at the Holiday Inn at Fisherman's Wharf and called me. And I was in Southern California at the time, playing at a Unity church down there. And I came back up and I met her, and I really we just hit it off. Basically, we ended up getting married. She moved into the Volkswagen bus. So, I mean, I only had two drawers for my clothes, and I gave her one of my drawers. I mean, that was like, We found a little house in Healdsburg, way out on a dirt road in the middle of nowhere, and we got this grand piano, and we started making our first baby, right? It was a CD, and I was recording, and she was painting, and finally, after almost a year, it was released in 1994. She came over in 93. We got married, August 20th, 1993, so it's exactly 30 years ago in Santa Rosa. And then in 1994, we finished the album, and the very first time, it was called The Call, and the very first time we ever sold it publicly was right on that table on the patio right there. And back in 1994, that was the first album. We've got like 10 albums now, and books and paintings and art and cards and all kinds of stuff, lots of little kids. So this place has really been such a important place in a sense. But we came here when Max Lasser was. We decided to move into an RV. We lived in an RV. We thought we'd try it for a year, And we ended up for 17 years just living in this RV and traveling all over North America. And every Sunday we were at a Unity church. So we've been to literally hundreds and hundreds of Unity churches, probably more than anyone, I guess, ever. You know, that's all we do is go to Unity churches. All over the United States and other places in Europe and Australia and Caribbean and all over, wherever there's a Unity. All 50 states, except for North Dakota. They don't have one. But when they get one, we'll go there. But so it's, you know, it's just really was wonderful to come back here, though, in our RV sometimes. And I remember when Max Lasser was here, when David MacArthur was here. But the last time we were here was 2003. So it's been 20 years, which is kind of amazing. And we met Kristen Powell, of course, when we were traveling in our RV. She was in Missouri, and we used to go to her church quite a bit. She had a wonderful ministry there. And so it's so great to see she's here now. And I want to really thank all of you, because I know a lot of you have been here through thick and thin, and that's so important to keep this Unity teaching alive. And I think, you know, it's really wonderful that there's this series going of the 12 powers of man. Have any of you read the 12 powers of man? Like, the 12th power is this one, the power of life. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about that, because I think it's such an interesting one. It's the very last one in his book. And he calls it generative life, the power of generative life. And the disciple, he's the disciple for all of the powers, the disciple for this one is Judas, right? And so he uses that as a teaching, that the power of life, which is really the fundamental power, if it's going in alignment with our wisdom, then it's a tremendous power. But if it's not going in alignment with our wisdom, it can become a servant of harm, of destruction, of death, of imprisonment, of fear, and so forth. And so he really, in this chapter on life, gives that teaching. I think it's very important that we're called to develop our inner capacity of wisdom so that we can channel the power of life in the right direction. And he emphasizes, if you read the chapter, that it's very important to not allow our yearning or our craving, our desire for lust and for greed and so forth, that these things, which are really in many ways supported by the corporate and advertising culture in our society, they're kind of promoting in many ways the harming us to get us to stay at sort of a low vibrational level where we're always wanting something to fulfill these desires. And he's really strong about this. He said, don't let that happen. If you do, you'll lose your sight and your hearing and you'll get sick. He says, you know, really channel the energy to the highest level that you possibly can. There's this teaching in the Sanskrit tradition, Brahmacharya, which is sort of like to try to sublimate the energy. Bring your energy. Don't just sort of waste it on low-level striving or competing or trying to grasp at things, but try to send it up to a higher level of enlightenment or awakening or creating beauty. That's one of the things I love about Madeline. She really creates beauty in her art and just everywhere she goes. She makes her own clothes and does all these things. And I think it's, you know, it's a, and we have a garden. We have 75 fruit and nut trees. You know, we really grow our own food now. It's really cool. I couldn't do that in the RV. All I could do was grow sprouts. But now we actually... We have vegetables and fruits and all this stuff. So we're up in Lake County. We ended up finally, after 17 years, we found a house out in the middle of nowhere up there in Lake County, and we're up there. But coming back to this idea, so I think it's really the underlying teaching is to reconnect with our inner guidance system, our wisdom. And that's something that's really at the core of the Unity teaching. It's one of the reasons I love Unity. Two reasons. One is that it's really based at a very deep level on the idea of inclusiveness, really inclusive. I remember when I was raised in New England in an Episcopalian church, which was good, but there was this underlying idea that we had the sort of the one right creed, the one right teaching, and you better stick with this and don't go anywhere else, you know, or you won't go to the heaven. It's our heaven. We, you know. And I found it so refreshing when I discovered Unity, because it's this open honoring of all the wisdom traditions of humanity, tremendous heritage of wisdom from the Eastern traditions, from the Western, and really looking deeply into Christianity to see the underlying message, not just the surface, but to go deeper into it. And so there's that idea of inclusiveness. And then the other idea that I think is so important is the idea of each one of us having our own inner guidance system. Like Charles Fillmore said, we don't have to have it mediated by someone else. He said, I go straight to headquarters, right? You know, each one of us can go straight to headquarters. That idea that we have that connection. You know, for him it was easy because he could just go straight to headquarters by saying, well, I'm just going to go see what Myrtle thinks, you know, and see. Because there's no way to go wrong if you do that. But, you know, that represents in a way the inner feminine wisdom, which is so important for all of us. But the underlying idea in unity is that we are really called to do the inner work. It's not just relying on someone to carry us up there. You know, we are called to purify our consciousness, to quiet our mind, to connect with our inner wisdom. And I think that's an amazingly precious teaching in our time, and to have that kind of inclusiveness. And so I want to just say, like, for myself, like I said earlier, I was raised in New England, but it was actually kind of a neat place to be raised because it was Concord, Massachusetts, actually. And that was the birthplace of the Transcendentalist movement. So I learned to swim in Walden Pond. I was born in Emerson Hospital. I went to Thoreau School and Alcott School, you know. And so there was this whole feeling of the Transcendentalists. And I found out later, you know, they were like Alcott. I mean, Thoreau actually had the largest library in North America of books on Taoism and Buddhism and Vedanta and so forth. And they were really bringing in some of these teachings, which really are very important in the New Thought movement. The idea, for example, that God is equally male as female, right? That idea from the Hindu tradition, or the idea from the Buddhist tradition of God as infinite mind, or the idea from the Taoist tradition of God as this principle. You know, you can learn to trust, and it's just, you know, that idea. And these ideas, I think, really enrich and very exciting to people like Charles Fillmore, Emerson, Thoreau, and it's part of, I think, the wisdom of humanity. So I remember for myself, as I went away to college, I was struggling somewhat. My father had a whole chain of newspapers, and I was basically going to take that over. And so I was studying, you know, English and also business and so forth. But I remember later I heard about Joseph Campbell and his whole idea of a midlife crisis. He said a midlife crisis is when you're climbing up a ladder and you get pretty far up on the ladder and you realize, I'm on the wrong wall here. I don't even want to go up here. You know. And so I remember feeling that feeling. I'm climbing up this ladder, and where is it taking me? You know, I didn't really. So I started reading Emerson and Thoreau, and they led me to this other book, which some of you may have heard of. I always like to mention this book because it was just the perfect book at that time. It's an old book from the 1890s, Cosmic Consciousness. This guy, Richard Buck, wrote this way back. And the basic thesis is very simple. He said, everybody that we see, we're all at the state of self-consciousness. In other words, we have this. We've developed out of what he calls simple consciousness to self-consciousness, which is basically caring about ourself and maybe a few people around us. But he said a few people like Jesus and the Buddha and great sages and saints and poets and mystics, both men and women through the ages, had been able to make this sort of quantum leap to what he called cosmic consciousness, where we lose this sort of petty interest in just myself and my own welfare. And we start to care about everyone. And we have this sense of love and caring, a loss of the fear of death, and this, what he called an intellectual illumination and a moral elevation. And he said that what I really loved was, he said, it is the destiny of all human beings to attain cosmic consciousness. That's really our purpose here. And we're sort of born here, and we're distracted from that continually. We're taught that we're not enough, we're not good enough, we have to compete with each other, it's not enough to go around. And so we lose sight of that. But these great founders of religions and spiritual beacons have been shining that light and trying to remind us and get us to remember that. So I remember getting really like, wow, everything else is just a distraction. I remember going back home on the holiday and saying, Mom and Dad, you know about cosmic consciousness, right? You know, that's why we're here. We're not here just to grub for money and try to get things. We're here to attain this higher level of awareness. And I remember my father saying, yeah, you know, this education of yours, it's costing me quite a lot of money, actually. And I mean, how is that going to help you get ahead in the world? And so I talked to him about it. And the nice thing was, you know, he somewhat understood. He played the piano and kind of taught me, actually, to play. And my mother was an artist. But what was really interesting was that my younger brother, Ed, he was totally on board. He said, yes, we have to attain cosmic consciousness. That's the thing. And so we were just, you know, we were just, like, he was 18, I was 20. I graduated from college, Colby College in Maine, and we thought about it. What do we do now? We're going to attain cosmic consciousness. How do we do it? And I was like, what do we do? But then we suddenly, like a lightning bolt came down and told us what to do. It's obvious, actually, when you think about it. To attain a cosmic consciousness, it's easy. All you have to do is go to California. Oh. So we did. We actually, you know, I remember talking to my parents about it. My father was great. He actually gave us his blessing and said, okay, you know, every man, he actually quoted Thoreau. He said, every man must march to the beat of the drum that he hears, you know? All right. So we walked down the driveway with little backpacks, a few things, fresh baked cookies for my mother, and we headed west. After about a month and a half or so, we got as far as Buffalo. And in Buffalo, it was freezing. And so we decided to just walk south, and we ended up walking about maybe 20, 30 miles a day, 20 miles a day usually, all the way down across upstate New York into Pennsylvania, all the way across Pennsylvania into West Virginia. When we got to West Virginia, it was like we're in the Bible Belt. I didn't know what that meant, but I found out pretty quickly. They try to save us every night, yeah. And we worked our way through and then into eastern Kentucky and eventually into Tennessee, and we stopped for a while in the largest hippie commune in the world at that point was in was called The Farm, and just south of Nashville. And so we stayed there, and they were about 900 people at that point, and they were all from California. So so from San Francisco, really. So we stayed there, and that was where actually I learned to just never eat meat again. I was really kind of, because they were all vegetarians, actually vegans, but no one knew that word back then. And I found out, you know, I don't need to eat animal food, so I haven't actually now for over 40 years. And Madeline, I found out the same month and year, she also decided to never eat meat in her life in Switzerland way back then. But anyway, we were there, and then we continued on, and we walked down to Huntsville, Alabama, and we found a Zen center there. You probably think I'm lying, but there was a Zen center in Huntsville. And so we lived there and meditated, and then eventually I got out to San Francisco, and I lived in a Tibetan Buddhist center and Zen center, and then I ended up shaving my head and becoming a Zen Buddhist monk in South Korea back in the early 1980s, and just doing a lot of meditating. But then when I eventually decided to come back into the world and got my PhD at Berkeley and taught college, but I discovered, really rediscovered unity, and I realized that unity is an amazingly precious movement. Because it has this tremendous wisdom there that really draws the essence of the world's wisdom traditions, and it has an open forum, an open vessel to really bring this to the world. So I just thought this serving unity is a great thing, because this movement is really in many ways pure gold. It really empowers people to connect with the healing capacities and the inner wisdom that we all have. And so so that's the thing that I think, you know, we've been doing that so much now. I'm just going to Unity Churches because I think this is where the real power in our society is in many ways. It's a spiritual power that's open and inclusive and empowers us to reconnect in our own way and then to create classes and context to increase that. But I just want to close with this idea that the very core of our being, I think it's covered up by our upbringing and by the general way that we run our society. There's a bubbling spring of joy that's always present. It's very much buried often because I'm not getting what I want and I'm getting what I don't want and I'm struggling with other people who feel the same way. You know, we're kind of wishing they would change or wishing they wouldn't change or whatever it is. We're always in this sort of situation. Buddhism, that's called samsara. It means that's the delusion of being this fundamentally separate self and trying to manipulate. And the whole idea is that if we can begin to reconnect with our true nature and realize that what we are was never born and will never die. We are the life that lives through this vehicle. In the Buddhist tradition, there's this idea of the footprint. You know, the footprint was actually the symbol before they ever had statues. They didn't have that until they took the movement went actually to Greece, and they said, "Well, you got to have a statue of this guy." You know, before that, it was a footprint. Think about a footprint. When you go to the beach, you see a footprint there, and you don't go, "Oh, hello, George, how are you doing?" You know, it's just a footprint, right? And so this right now, this is a footprint waving. You know, you cannot see the being. We see this. We see footprints, right? We see, but the being. But we can learn to see the being actually when we quiet our own mind and connect with our own true nature. We can do that, and then we can become healers in many ways. We can see the divine in each other, and when we do that, we begin to connect with the joy that is our true nature. I remember that on that walk with my brother. We were walking down through some little town, or not hardly any town, just walking through the woods or wherever. And I would have these waves of joy coming over me, and there was no logical reason for that to happen. We had no money, we had no security, we weren't doing what we were told to do, but I was happy because I was living my life. I think that's the key thing. When intuition, we'll talk about this afternoon, but intuition is really this inner guidance system. It doesn't make our life easy necessarily, but it makes it our life. You know, it creates the possibility of authenticity to live our own life however it is. And when we do that, we actually just, that's the best thing we can give to others, is living our own life. We don't have to try to change them, just change this one. And then when we do that, we create a field around us that encourages others in their own way to do the same thing. And so I think that's the beautiful thing. So I'll just close with this final idea that I think in the Buddhist tradition, there are the idea of the three jewels. The three jewels are the most precious things, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Buddha is our own true nature. We call it in unity the Christ nature, right? This is the eternal being that is our true nature that we're here to awaken. The Dharma is the teaching, the precious teaching that helps us to awaken to our inner Christ. So there's the Buddha and the Dharma, and then the third one is the Sangha. And the Sangha is the community of people who are earnestly striving to attain a higher consciousness and to connect with the Buddha nature or the Christ nature. And the Buddha said a very interesting thing. He said, if there is no Sangha, there will be no Buddha and no Dharma. Now, that's a really important point. See, that's why it's so wonderful that we come together like this, because we can all stay in our own little shell and work on our teaching. But when we actually help to bring the teaching to other people and help bring it from generation to generation, that's so important, because without that, our whole society goes into darkness. These teachings, the Dharma teachings, they're universal, and they really require us to transform our consciousness out of the delusion that's being imposed on us by our society. Remember what Krishnamurti said. He said, it's not a good idea to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society. You know, that's the thing. And so we're getting bombarded all the time with authority figures telling us do this and do that and be like this and be like that on the media and everywhere. And the whole idea is to connect with our own inner authority and live from that place. So I want to thank all of you for making those efforts, not only on your inner self, but together. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. I'd like to close with just a short piece of music. And in honor of our 30th wedding anniversary today, this is a piece that was on that first album, The Call, and it's called Benediction of Light. And it was really the first piece that Madeline, I think, heard. And kind of to help bring in, I think what's really wanting to be born on this earth right now, which is a world of harmony and peace and joy and freedom. So I just invite you, as you're listening, to let the music evoke imagery, and we can just send a benediction out into our world for the benefit of all beings. Enjoy. Thank you very much. have our closing, I think our affirmation. Yeah, here it is. Let's say that. I guess we say that together. I give thanks for the inner wisdom guiding the power of life within me every day into a greater joy, freedom, abundance, love, and authenticity for the benefit of all. Much love to you all. Thanks again. Thank you.